Robert Van Gent, not to be confused with Bob Van Gent or Robert Van Gent, the other astronomer, is an astronomer working at the Institute for History and Foundations of Mathematics and Natural Sciences in Utrecht. He gained a PhD in astronomy in 1989. He's currently working on a joint project with the Utrecht Research Programme into the history of cartography and with the Astronomical Institute of Utrecht on the history of Dutch celestial cartography. Robert cites his main interests as calendars, chronology, the history of astrology, cartography, navigation, stellar and planetary astronomy, and anything even slightly related to the topics. And you might say he's starstruck. He's also harboured a long-standing dream to be the Royal Astronomer. And I don't think that's happened yet. Well, he joins me now from Utrecht, and sorry to drag you away from your telescope, Robert.
Good morning.
How are you?
Well, I'm fine, thank you.
Now, the Royal Astronomer thing, let's get that out of the way. There's a picture of you, I think, on your website, isn't it, with the Royal Astronomer hat?
Yes, but that was a picture taken long, long ago on St. Nicholas Day. I don't know whether you've heard of St. Nicholas, but he is a kind of a Santa Claus figure.
Yes.
And we always make fun of each other on those days. And, well, one of my colleagues thought it would be fun to put a kind of astrologist cap on my head with the title Royal Astronomer. But, well, as I explained on my webpage, it hasn't happened yet.
Okay.
And I don't expect it will happen anytime soon.
Right. Let's go back to the beginning. When did you first become interested in astrology?
Astronomy, you mean?
Astronomy, I beg your pardon. Astronomy,
well,
sorry.
Mean, well, it started with an interest in astronomy. That was in my high school days when I was about 15, 16 years old. A friend of mine, he got a telescope from his parents, and, well, he invited me to have a look through it. And, well, from that moment on, I was hooked.
And it's just grown from that point?
Yes, it has. Before that, I had an interest in chemistry, making all kinds of nasty things which explode and smell foully. But this one peek through the telescope cured me from all of that.
Because you're always finding something new, I think, aren't you?
Well, astronomers do. Well, to be honest, I'm not really an astronomer in the modern sense that I myself do observing. As you have gathered from a webpage, I'm more interested now in the history of astronomy.
Yes.
Which means that you look at old books, manuscripts, maps, etc., and discovering all the exciting new stuff like quasars and exploding galaxies and stars, that's done by other people and not by me. I mean, I do read about it, of course, with much interest, but I do not do any modern astronomical research anymore.
So in terms of the astronomical history, what are you hoping to achieve by studying that field? That they were right, that they were accurate? I mean, because they had virtually nothing to work with back in the very early days, did they? They certainly didn't have...
That is certainly true. Well, there's one important thing which explains why astronomers are interested in those ancient observations. It's because in chemistry and physics, if you want to discover something, you just do new experiments. You build a new particle accelerator, or you have all kinds of fancy laboratory stuff. But in astronomy, you cannot repeat things in a laboratory. I mean, you can just simply observe and watch and wait for things to happen. But, well, mostly nothing happens. But in that case, ancient observations, even if they were made with simpler instruments or even before 1600, just with the naked eye, can be of interest to astronomers, because most things in the heavens, they occur at a much slower pace.
But they were constantly changing, weren't they?
Well,
isn't
yes.
That right?
I mean, yes, but well, I mean, if you look at the stars, at the constellations, the figures of the constellations are now more or less the same as they were 2,000 years ago when they were observed by the Greeks or even earlier by the Babylonians. But things like the motions of the planets, that is something else. I mean, they change constantly, and we have, of course, nowadays very good algorithms for predicting their motions, but they're not infinitely precise. I mean, even those ancient observations which were made by Greek or Babylonian astronomers are still useful for modern astronomers for fine-tuning their programs.
Wow.
Because it was done more than 2,000 years ago, and then even a small error can accumulate to something which is observable.
Right, right. Now, talking about things that are observable, let's get on to the international dateline, because it's not observable,
okay.
Is it?
No, it's not a line which you can find drawn across the...
That's right.
Just like the equator, you don't find that line. Well, I mean, there are a few places on the Earth where, in fact, the equator is laid out in stone, I mean, just like the Greenwich Meridian, but the international dateline, because it passes over water, I mean, that's the way it's been defined nowadays. You won't find any visible trace of it.
So, explain why it passes over water.
Well, that's just for convenient reasons. I mean, if you have a dateline, I mean, as I explained on my webpage, that's the place where the date changes, for instance, from Wednesday to Thursday. You would not like to have that happen in your own country, because then you would have one half of your country living in Wednesday and you would have the other half living in Thursday, which is not very convenient for making all kinds of appointments. So the way the dateline is nowadays marked on globes and on atlases is that it skirts the boundaries of all nations involved which are adjacent to it.
Right. So it can't be a straight line, in other words.
No. I mean, that's the way that has to do with the geography of our globe. I mean, by defining the Greenwich Meridian as the prime meridian, we were more or less lucky that its antipodes, which is 180 degrees away, passes mostly through water, but I mean, it doesn't exactly. I mean, it makes a slight bend to the east in the Bering Strait. Otherwise, it would pass through the former Soviet Union, and in the middle of the Pacific Ocean, there have also been some adjustments so that certain groups of islands are on the same side of the dateline.
Because Kiribati had that Wednesday Thursday problem, didn't it? That was the
They had that problem, Kiribati, if I pronounce it correctly. They had that problem until 1994, and at that time they decided, well, it was enough, and they then decided, well, we'll have the dateline running on the eastern side of our border.
Which doesn't cause any problems, does it? I mean, it's just a notional line.
I mean, every country can make its own decision. I mean, it has to do, in a more general term, in which time zone you want to be. Mm. I mean, if you look at the map of the time zones, I mean, formerly they were defined as strips of land which are 15 degrees of width. But I mean, if you look at the time zone map of the world, which you can easily find on the internet, you find all kinds of detours so that it follows the borders of your country.
Right. So when was it decided on originally? When was the international dateline as such? Because, I mean, explorers in particular knew that there was a problem with times and dates, didn't they, way, way back?
Yes. I mean, Magellan, Ferdinand Magellan, his voyage, which was around 1520, the survivors of his voyage, they already encountered it in a practical form when they arrived back in Spain, that they noticed there was a day's difference between their reckoning and of their countrymen.
And they kept very accurate records, didn't they?
Yes, they kept day by day records. I mean, some of the people when they came back in Spain questioned them, well, did you really keep good records? Perhaps you were sick one day and forgot to make a note in your journal. But I mean, they had of course several people keeping journals on those vessels, and they all concurred with each other, no, we did not make any mistake. And even before that, in the 14th century, philosophers had already argued that if you would make a circumnavigation of the globe, you would encounter such a problem. That there would be a day's error in your reckoning, depending on whether you go westward or whether you would go eastward.
Eastwards, yes.
One day, in one case, you would lose a day, in another case, you would actually gain a day. That was, in fact, already figured out by philosophers and astronomers in the 13th and 14th century, even before a circumnavigation had been made.
Yeah, it seems extraordinary. I mean, I find it difficult to grasp the concept now. I mean, back then, they had very little to work with, and yet they'd worked out that you would, in fact, do that, lose a day or gain a day. How would they have done that?
Well, I mean, first of all, they knew that the Earth was a sphere. I mean, you always hear this popular myth that people in the Middle Ages thought that the world was flat, and that if you would sail away to the west or the east, you would eventually fall off. But I mean, that's nonsense. I mean, every educated person in the Middle Ages knew that the Earth was round. So and they were familiar how sunrise and sunset, how that occurs. Of course, they then still believed that the Earth was in the center of the universe and that the sun revolved around Earth. Nowadays, of course, we know that, in fact, the sun is stationary in our planetary system, and it's the Earth which goes around the Sun, and it's the rotation of the Earth which makes the Sun go rise, makes the Sun go up and down. But for explaining this paradox, that doesn't really matter whether you put the Earth in the center of the universe or the Sun. That doesn't really matter. But so they already figured that out. The medieval man, they didn't have computers and all kinds of fantasy stuff, but I mean they had the same brains we have.
Right.
So, yes. so if we can figure it out, they could also, and we find evidence for that in their writings.
The International Meridian Conference in Washington in October 1844, that's where it actually all started, isn't it? Officially?
Yes, I mean, it was at that conference that they recommended that the Greenwich Meridian, which passes through the eastern part of London, that would be the prime meridian.
Mm-hmm.
There was a bit of opposition by the French because they had hoped that it would be Paris.
Of course.
But anyway, the Greenwich Meridian got most of the votes.
Right.
And and at the same time, if you put the prime meridian there, then the logical step would be to have the date line where the calendar date changes. You would want to have that 180 degrees away. And well, by its location in Greenwich, it simply happened that most of the date line now passes through the Pacific.
Right.
I mean, if they had recommended a different prime meridian, like Paris or Rome or even Jerusalem, as some argued, then the whole dateline would have shifted by the same amount eastwards.
Yep.
And then would have passed to, well, a large part of North America, which, well, would have been rather inconvenient.
Now, the prime meridian doesn't change, does it?
No, that's fixed. Well, I mean, fixed in the sense if you neglect things like continental motion, but, I mean, that is so very slow.
Mm.
I mean, it's only with very precise measurements that you can actually measure the slight shifting of the continents. But for practical reasons, it's constant, yes.
There have also been some literary, quite a number of literary references, but the one that I enjoyed was Edgar Allan Poe and Three Sundays in a Week.
Edgar Allan Poe story.
Yes, yes, and also Jules Verne, of course, Around the World in 80 Days.
Well, I mean, everybody knows Jules Verne's story, but I mean, Poe's story is, of course, much less known.
Mm.
But he was, in fact, before Jules Verne came with this idea, at least to put it in a novel. I mean, as far as I can tell, I mean, there are probably earlier stories in which the dateline also plays a role, but I haven't found them, and if one of your listeners may happen to know an earlier story than Poe's story, I would be glad to hear it.
Right, yes.
And I can even put it in my website. And something else which I would also like to know, I mean, I know very little about history of New Zealand. I know it was discovered by Albert Tasman in the 1640s, and of course you have James Cook exploring its coasts. But exactly how New Zealand was settled by the Europeans, I don't actually know whether they from the beginning already used the Asian date and not the American date, so
they would use the British date, I presume.
Well, I mean, with
the plus or minus, yes.
Yes, I mean that they wouldn't. I mean, not like the Philippines. I mean, the Philippines they have for a very long time until 1844. They actually used the American date, while you would assume by their geographical location that they would have followed the Asian date.
Just explain that a little more. The American date and the Asian date. What do you mean by that?
Well, I mean, it has to do with the dateline again.
Because you're right.
The dateline is a bit in the middle of the Pacific Ocean. Everything on the American side, so to speak, follows the American date. I mean, like Hawaii and Samoa, if I pronounce it correctly. But I mean, the islands just on the other side of the dateline, they follow the Asian date.
Right.
I mean, the same as in Japan or in China, or for the same respect as in Australia and in New Zealand.
So a day ahead or a day behind?
Always have to think again.
I'm not trying to catch you up.
No, but I mean, it's something...
No, America's a day behind in terms of the Asian date, that's it, yes.
Okay, yeah. Yes, yeah. Well, yes, I mean, it's very easy to get confused. I mean, I also sometimes get confused. I mean, just like summertime and daylight saving time.
Absolutely.
The clock go an hour backwards or forwards. And I always get confused myself, so I also have to look it up too.
So, Robert, the Philippines declaration, they determined Monday the 30th of December 1844 would be followed by Wednesday the 1st of January 1845. Now, why was that?
Well, that was because until 1844, they were actually following the American date.
Right.
And that has to do with the way the Philippines were colonized by the Spanish. I mean, the Spanish, they first colonized America, or let's say discovered and then colonized America, and then consequently, they went further on to the east, and then they encountered the Philippines. And nowadays, you would say, well, if you travel from the Philippines to Europe, you would do that via the Indian Ocean, go around Africa. But that's not the way that the things went in the 17th and 18th century. Everything from the Philippines going to Spain first went to Central America, was transported overland, and then through the Caribbean and the Atlantic Ocean to Spain. So for practical reasons, it was convenient to have the Philippines, Central America, and Europe on the same day count.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
But in the 1840s, the Philippines, well, I mean, the ties with the motherland, Spain, had already been severed, found it more convenient with trading with China and the Dutch East Indies and Australia, etc., to follow the Asian day count, because there was always a day difference.
Right.
That's why they made that switch in 1844.
Well,
consequent.
I think I kind of understand. The thing that I was most surprised by was that the international date line is not a straight line, that it does actually weave and its way through so that it stays in water, essentially, except through Antarctica.
Yeah, well, of course,
it doesn't matter too much.
There's no, of course, true. But yeah. I mean, there's nobody actually living there except a number of polar research stations. So
yes,
and they keep more or less their own time system.
And the penguins don't mind at all.
And the penguins wouldn't mind at all.
No. now, some of your other interests, Robert. Tell me a bit about the celestial cartography. That must be an extraordinarily intricate process to go through.
Yes, no, that's quite true. I mean, that's one of the fun things with the history of astronomy, because it touches so many cultures and also so many time eras. I mean, you might perhaps be surprised to know that many of the constellations which you now see in the sky, which are used by modern astronomers, were in fact already known by Greek astronomers and even by Babylonian astronomers. I mean, the celestial lion. And many other constellations, you already find them mentioned on the Babylonian clay tablets. Now, in your case, in New Zealand, of course, you have a totally different sky than we have here in Northern Europe. I mean, there are a lot of constellations which I cannot see, which I've never actually seen before. I mean, all those constellations around the Southern Celestial Pole.
Yes, like the Southern Cross, etc.
Yes, the Southern Cross, for instance. And it's interesting to know that most of those constellations were, in fact, they were, of course, seen by the first Spanish, Portuguese, and Italian travelers to the Southern Hemisphere, but they were not actually, measured with any precision until the Dutch made their first journeys to the East Indies.
Uh-huh.
And many of those constellations, which are now situated around the Southern Celestial Pole, were, in fact, first catalogued by Dutch seamen around 1595.
The Dutch were very keen on cartography altogether, weren't they? Not just celestial.
Yeah, no, certainly at the end of the 16th and during most of the 17th century and even part of the 18th century, I mean, the best maps, the best charts, the best globes came from the Netherlands and in particular from Amsterdam. I mean, there was quite a large industry there of publishers who tried to make the best atlases. And not only atlases of the world, but, I mean, also sea atlases and also a few celestial atlases.
And astonishingly accurate, too.
Well, I mean, accurate in the sense using the best data which they had at that moment. I mean, of course, for a long time, there was a problem of determining your longitude. I mean, that was not really solved until the middle of the 18th century with clocks made by John Harrison, an English clockmaker. Mm.
Yeah.
So I mean, if you look at old maps of the world, I mean, you would notice that the latitudes are mostly correct, but that the longitudes are often very much in error. I mean, if you look at the Mediterranean Ocean on early maps, it's far too wide, and other continents
are
a bit distorted. But that all changes in the 18th century when more accurate methods for determining longitude become available.
Right, better measuring devices, in other words.
Yes, I mean, especially the use of chronometers on vessels. That really made a big difference. And if you look at the 19th century atlas, I mean, the errors are then very small if compared with modern atlases.
Robert, we're going to have to leave it there, and I'm sorry about that because it's been a fascinating discussion, and I very much appreciate your time.
I very much enjoyed talking with you.
Thank you very much indeed. That's Robert Van Gent, who is an astronomer, but he's into so many things that it's probably a slight misnomer simply to call him an astronomer.